All right, Mr. Shelley, good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Anthony Shelley on behalf of the appellant Michael Oki. In our briefs, we've listed three different reasons as to why the district court erred in dismissing the case for lack of jurisdiction. One reason is because the court relied on a preclusion rule stemming from the Northwest Airlines case, and we assert that that case is no longer good law. Another reason is because the lower court found the Railway Labor Act, the RLA, arbitration requirement to be jurisdictional. We assert it's not jurisdictional and that it can and has been forfeited. But the court doesn't need to get to either of those issues if it doesn't wish to, because the court can accept the Northwest Airlines preclusion rule and that it's jurisdictional use it here in the sense that of applying it as good law, but in the end, on the unique facts of this case, it has no application or operation. So I'd like to just for a second talk about the facts, because they are relevant, obviously, to the application of the rule. Mr. Oki served as a U.S. Airways pilot starting in 1988, and upon contracting leukemia, he began obtaining benefits. This is about 2002. He began obtaining benefits from the U.S. Airways disability plan. He received those benefits for about a year, and then he was furloughed by his employer. And he was sent a letter saying that because of the furlough, you're no longer going to receive your disability benefits. This letter that he received is quite important for what it states and what it doesn't state. First of all, it doesn't state the basis on which the plan provision on which this termination of benefits was based. That's a violation of Department of Labor regulations. What it did state was that if Mr. Oki didn't like the termination, he could administratively appeal that pursuant to ERISA, specifically mentioning ERISA. It also said that if he didn't like the result of the appeal, after the appeal, he could file a suit in federal court under ERISA. The letter made no mention of the Railway Labor Act, no mention of an arbitration requirement. It just said ERISA. And so Mr. Oki, when he got his termination letter, his benefits termination letter, he thought it was wrong because he never understood that the plan allowed for termination of benefits based on a furlough, and so he requested an explanation from the plan. What provision of the plan are you relying on? Over and over he requested, and finally he was sent one page from a 1997 restatement of the plan. And it said that had a provision in there that you're not entitled to benefits if you've been furloughed. Well, the plan also never issued a summary plan description for him to understand his rights, and ultimately then not agreeing that the 1997 plan was at all valid because in his view it had never been signed by the union, and that an earlier plan, the 1975 plan, governed, he did what the letter that the plan sent him told him to do. He filed a lawsuit under ERISA. And he filed it back in 2003. And ERISA is a comprehensive statute. It applies to every private employer benefit plan. It applies to unionized plan, it applies to collectively bargain plans, it applies to railroad plans, it applies to airline plans. The only plans it doesn't apply to are church plans and government plans. This isn't either of those. So he filed his lawsuit under ERISA. It went on for several years. There were a lot of other parties, a lot of other claims. 9 years later, U.S. Airways raises the allegation that the case is barred for lack of jurisdiction. Because Mr. Oki should have used the arbitration remedy under the RLA as opposed to the ERISA remedy it told him to follow. There are cases that hold that the RLA can preclude an ERISA claim. We assert that this isn't good law anymore, but let's assume it is for now. All these cases set forth the same standard, and I don't think there's really a disagreement about the standard at this point for preclusion by the RLA of ERISA, and that is that the RLA will preclude an ERISA claim only if the ERISA claim for its resolution turns on the construction of the plan terms of the collective bargaining agreement. So the ERISA claim has to, for its resolution, require the construction of the plan. Here that cannot be the case because the central allegation is that the plan itself is illegitimate. If the 1997 plan is illegitimate, let's start a different way. If the 1997 plan is legitimate and therefore the plan's basis for which it denied benefits. If it's legitimate, Mr. Oki agrees that he's not entitled to benefits because it has an express exclusion for furloughed workers. But if it's illegitimate, then the plan must lose because the only basis that it ever set forth for the denial of benefits, for the termination of benefits, was the 1997 plan. It can't raise new arguments in court. Its administrator never brought this up. Mr. Oki appealed under ERISA to the administrator. Administrator never resolved the appeal, never answered it. 9 years later, we've never received an answer. And so they're not permitted in court to raise these new arguments based on an earlier plan that only come up now on appeal, here even. So if that were the case, once this issue is resolved, the case would be over. Mr. Oki would get his benefits either way. So.
Wait, I don't understand. If the 97 restatement is invalid, then for him to get benefits, it has to come from some plan, and that's the 75 plan. And the 75 plan says active service.
He was already.
I mean, at least that's at least what U.S. Air is saying.
Well, it's saying that here now. It's not what the plan administrator, the fiduciary, ever said. The plan administrator and fiduciary only relied on the 1997 plan. U.S. Airways can't bring up new arguments for terminating his benefits. He was entitled to benefits. He was getting them. He didn't have to prove an entitlement to benefits. He was already receiving them. The question is whether they can terminate them. And he was the ERISA law is pretty straightforward that on administrative review, the plan can, if it were.
No, what I'm asking is if it can't be terminated under the 97 restatement because that's invalid, then what is it being paid pursuant to?
The 1975 plan.
Right, the 75 plan.
Yes.
All right. So that is, whether they relied on it or not, that's what's giving him his benefits if the 97 restatement is invalid.
Yes.
All right, and the 75 plan says active service. Which a furloughed pilot is not in active service.
A couple of answers to the question. First of all, to reiterate the point, the plan never made this argument, and it can't now. The cases like Lauder, which we cited in our brief, hold that the plan must abide by the denial that it stated, which was the 97 plan. So it's come up with these theories now on appeal that the 75 plan has this active service requirement in order to challenge the benefits, but their lawyer's not able to do that. The fiduciary has to do it. Maybe a remand back to the plan administrator to look at that would be appropriate, but this case still wouldn't involve construction of the plan terms because a remand isn't a construction of the plan terms. The ERISA statute is straightforward in giving a right to the party, to Mr. Oki here, and it can only be taken away in the narrow circumstance if the case involves the construction of the plan terms. And under Your Honor's scenario, it would not. It could be remanded, and the plan administrator might have to look at it.
Why isn't that then a construction of the plan's terms? I'm not understanding that. The only right you have here is under the plan's terms. And so ERISA takes away, ERISA normally gives you a right, but in this circumstance, when it involves construction of the plan's terms, it goes into a different proceeding, right?
You mean back to the remand?
No, back to the administrative process.
Well, if that were the case and it involves construction there, that's not what the court would be doing. The only question is whether the court, in resolving this case that Mr. Oki brought, would be interpreting the plan terms. And if it sends the case back for a remand, it wouldn't be. It would be saying to the plan administrator, you've now raised a new argument.
Is that the way to think about it? I mean, perhaps it is, but the way I thought about it is he gets relief or doesn't get relief based on what is in the language of the plan. And the RLA says when that's the nature of the dispute, it doesn't belong in federal courts. It belongs for the arbitrator. Now, what's wrong with that scenario?
Well, let's say the plan administrator had said the 1997 plan, let's say they relied on the 1975 plan. They said you're not an active worker.
Right.
That's highly disputed, by the way, that issue. But they say you're not an active worker. Mr. Oki takes the position, yes, I am,
right.
And he goes to court to now challenge the interpretation that the plan
right.
made. That would be the kind of case that I think all these other cases talk about. He's seeking benefits based on a construction of the plan terms he disagrees with the plan on.
We have no jurisdiction over that. That's right.
If you assume this rule is
right, exactly.
Yes. But that's not what his case is. Instead, they never said that. Instead, they said, here's the 1997 plan. This is why you were denied benefits. It has an exclusion for furloughed workers. we go to court saying, that's wrong. You cannot rely on the 1997 plan, and because it's invalid. That's the end of the case at that point. It either gets decided that the plan can't raise any new arguments, or it gets remanded back to the plan administrator for the new arguments to be considered by the plan administrator, but in no instance does it involve construction of the plan terms. And that's the key. ERISA gives a cause of action. It can only be taken away in a very narrow circumstance. If the case, for the district judge to resolve the case, he had to look at the plan terms and say there's a dispute about these plan terms. And there wasn't at the start of this case. It was only now that these issues are being raised that there's a dispute. And it's too late under the ERISA law. It's foreclosed from raising the dispute now. But the case, in any event, as Your Honor suggested, could be if it were remanded. Most courts wouldn't remand it, though. It would still not involve the court construing the plan. Perhaps if it were remanded, it could never come back.
Right.
At that point. It then might have to go to the, if they fought over this active service requirement, then it would have to go to the arbitration proceeding, assuming that ERISA is precluded by the RLA. But I would like to just, Judge Henderson, talk about this active service requirement. Again, we've been sort of, our side has been baited into talking about the 1975 plan, even though we don't think it's relevant, but by the briefing in the case. But the 1975 plan specifically says that benefits won't start for disability until the waiting period ends, and the waiting period ends when you depart active employment. So this argument that
you say it's not relevant if you win on the invalidity of the 97 restatement.
Yes.
It is. It's the only thing that gives him benefits.
It does, but the court won't have to construe the plan. He was getting benefits. The plan has never, the other side, the plan administrator never relied on the plan. But in any event, the 75 plan particularly says that, and this is on at the joint appendix at 589, it has a definition 1.4 benefit waiting period, which is the period ending with the later of the date the pilot becomes disabled or the date the pilot is removed from the active payroll. You don't become eligible for benefits till you become inactive, as it is. A disabled pilot is not an active pilot. And so this whole argument about, well, he was taken out of active service and therefore can't receive disability benefits it's a phony in our view, because the disabled pilot isn't in active service to begin with, so the furloughing didn't change that status of activity. There's no way to get around that provision. Instead, it's more of an eligibility issue they're talking about, whether you become covered in the first place. You have to be an active pilot to be covered by the policy in the first place, and he was starting in 1988. So that's our main argument in the case. Just first, I save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right. It is reply. Remember that.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Robertson?
May it please the court, Mark Robertson for the U.S. Airways, Inc. Pilot Disability Plan. Appellant has raised a host of issues to an attempt to complicate this matter, but this is a very straightforward case that boils down to a few key facts and is controlled by decisions of this court that are directly on point. As to the facts, there is no dispute here that the disability plan at issue is a collectively bargained plan that is governed by the Railway Labor Act. And second, there is no dispute that appellant's only claim in this litigation is for disability benefits under the plan. As to the key legal issues, there are three. Number one, ERISA itself does not provide for benefits to furloughed pilots. ERISA itself does not provide for benefits at all. And thus, whether or not appellant is entitled to benefits depends on the terms of the plan. Now, in the Northwest case, this court addressed an identical situation and held that an ERISA claim for benefits that requires interpretation of a collectively bargained plan must go to the system board, which has exclusive jurisdiction. Now, the Everett case, which was affirmed by this court, addressed the exact same situation and came to the exact same conclusion.
I think they're concerned as well that the original letter told them to go under ERISA.
Yes, Your Honor. That's come up in a number of cases that are out there where an original letter goes up because ERISA has statutory requirements that say you have to convey certain things, including that you have a right to state or federal court. And all of those courts have reached the same conclusion, which is that can't generate subject matter jurisdiction. And in fact, you know, Mr. Oki, in his brief below, even cites one of those cases, which is out of the Eighth Circuit, which is Bowe v. Northwest Airlines, 974 F. 2nd 101, and which expressly hold, and Mr. Oki cited for this proposition, you can't create jurisdiction by sending out a letter.
Might help him with the tolling argument on arbitration or something, but not here, right? Estoppel doesn't create jurisdiction.
It doesn't do it here. It can't do it. And in fact, there's actually a case.
Well, what is your position on the tolling in the arbitration?
Whether this is told and whether he can pursue arbitration, mm-hmm. That's simply a matter for the system board to decide. He needs to bring the claim and make his arguments, and they'll decide it. And
in Northwest, what will your position be?
The company could oppose it based on it being untimely. They could agree to let him do it. That has to come before the system board, and they'll make their decision. But I would point out, Your Honors, that in the Northwest decision, this court held, and in that argument, Northwest even said in that case, hey, it's been far too long for them to institute a grievance, and if they do, we're going to say it's untimely. And what this court held is said, that is a matter to be determined not in this suit, but in connection with the arbitration process. That's at page, it's the site is 627 F. 2nd at 278 note 12. So, Your Honor, that's a separate question. That's not before this court. The question before this court is whether you have jurisdiction or whether the district court correctly dismissed it for lack of jurisdiction. And now, Mr.
Why is it jurisdictional?
Why is it jurisdictional?
Because Sixth Circuit said it wasn't, right?
Well, the Sixth Circuit did, and the Sixth Circuit got it wrong. And the Sixth Circuit got it wrong for at least five reasons, Your Honor, which I'm happy to go through in some detail.
At least five?
At least five.
At least five. And it's very important because, to me, Your Honor, from our position, the arguments that, you know, Northwest has been overruled by Buell or the ERISA cases, that's just dead in the water.
But the jurisdictional issue, that's a little closer call, right? I mean, we're getting a lot of direction from up on First Street about jurisdiction. And
Yes, Your Honor, you're right. There's a lot of focus on that, and I think that may have led to the Sixth Circuit getting it wrong. But that is the only argument that really kind of, I think, deserves much attention here, and the only reason is because of the Sixth Circuit case. But let me spend some time walking through why we believe that case is just dead wrong. What the Supreme Court said in Arbol and the subsequent cases is you got to look at the statute, you got to look at the Supreme Court's historical treatment of the statute, and that's how you come to your conclusion. We don't want you to do these drive-by jurisdictional rulings. Then the Sixth Circuit comes out and they do a drive-by ruling. They don't look at the statute at all, they don't analyze it, and they fail to address or even reference the Supreme Court precedent that has directly held system board arbitration is exclusive. And if you'll indulge me, I'll give you just a moment to give you a sense of some of the Supreme Court cases.
Exclusive is different than jurisdictional.
Right.
But if it's exclusively to the court, to the arbitration board, then it is jurisdictional.
And you don't need this, do you? I mean, if it's mandatory requirement, why couldn't we just do it under 12b-6 instead of 12b-1?
You certainly could. Okay. At the end of the day,
then it was forfeited here, I think, is their argument, right?
Their argument, but Your Honor, on the record here, that argument is dead as well, because even in the Sixth Circuit case where they did dismiss it under 12b-6 and affirm the lower court's decision. By the way, where they affirm it, they said that the allegations that the plaintiff made in that case of futility, of collusion between the union and the employer were insufficient, and they were still going to dismiss it because there wasn't enough of a facts there. Here there's no facts or no argument whatsoever of collusion, of futility, none of that. It's simply not at play. There's nothing of that sort.
It was still 11 years before you all brought it up, right?
Well, Your Honor, there are some facts there, and, right. and that, including that it was stayed for several years. It was stayed, and this was the
How
first time.
How many of the 11 was it stayed?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that, and counsel may know, but it was stayed for several years. And I'd also point out that in the prior iterations of the complaint.
In fact, when was the first time that you all brought up the Railway Labor Act?
We brought it up immediately prior to them filing their second amended complaint, which was the first time in the history of this litigation that there was a sole plaintiff in the case, Mr. Oki. Prior to that, there had been multiple plaintiffs, and that there was a sole claim for benefits. Prior to that, they had brought what we would deem independent statutory disputes, which this court would have jurisdiction over. So it was the first time in the history of this case where the complaint could be moved under subject matter jurisdiction and the entire thing dismissed. And again, I don't think there can be any argument that during the stay, no one was required to raise these issues. Parties engaged in settlement talks. They indicated that they were going to go and move to have the case open. And at that point, the U.S. Airways indicated.
Which is your stronger argument, that there's no jurisdiction or that there's jurisdiction but you didn't forfeit the argument?
Your Honor, I think they're both very strong. And I think the only reason this
equally strong. They're equally strong.
I think the reason that the jurisdictional argument they have some potential legs there is simply because of the Sixth Circuit decision, which
well,
I think
it's just a Sixth Circuit decision. I mean, our work gets reviewed, right? And gets reviewed by a court that has sent some pretty strong signals that on jurisdiction, right? It's a tough issue.
It's a close call, right?
These are close call issues.
Well, could I spend a few minutes on that then, Your Honor, and tell you?
Your time.
The Sixth Circuit didn't look at the statute itself. And what the statute says, and this is in 45 U.S.C. Section 184, it shall be the duty of every carrier and its employees to establish a board of jurisdiction not exceeding the jurisdiction which may be lawfully exercised under 45 U.S.C. Section 153, which is the section establishing the National Railroad Adjustment Board, which came first in the RLA. And then, in turn, what 45-184 says is that, or what 153 says, is that the NRAB, like the system boards for air carriers, have jurisdiction over disputes between carriers and their employees growing out of the interpretation or application of collective bargaining agreements. And what the Supreme Court has held in a long line of cases from 1950 to the present is that this jurisdiction is exclusive. I can run through the site Slocum v. Delaware, 339 U.S. 239 at 1950, page 245. We hold that the jurisdiction of the board to adjust grievances and disputes of the type here involved is exclusive, and that involved interpretation of a CBA. 1959, Pennsylvania Railroad v. Day. We have held that the National Railroad Adjustment Board has exclusive primary jurisdiction over disputes between unions and carriers based on the provisions of a collective bargaining agreement. 1963, Supreme Court, Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers v. Louisville and Nashville Railroad. The statutory grievance procedure is a mandatory, exclusive, and comprehensive system for resolving grievance disputes. The right of one party to place the disputed issue before the adjustment board, with or without the consent of the other, has been firmly established. And this is the other. This is important. And the other party may not defeat this right by resorting to some other forum. 1963, I'll skip to 1972, Andrews v. Louisville and Nashville Railroad. The notion that the grievance and arbitration procedure provided for minor disputes in the Railway Labor Act are optional to be availed of as the employer or the carrier chooses was never good history and is no longer good law. In at least some situations, the Railway Labor Act makes the federal administrative remedy exclusive rather than merely requiring exhaustion of remedies in one forum before resorting to another.
So it's a combination of the precedent saying exclusive and the statutory term in jurisdiction.
That's exactly it, Your Honor. And these cases go on, and they go on all the way until 2009 in Union Pacific Railroad v. Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers. This is a case at 558 U.S. 67, 2009. And this is an important case which the Sixth Circuit didn't grapple with or explain at all. And the Sixth Circuit actually held this supports that the arbitration requirement is not jurisdictional. But what this case addresses, Union Pacific, is not the jurisdiction of the courts, but the jurisdiction of the National Railroad Adjustment Board, which is the equivalent of the board here under the law. And what they're addressing is the jurisdiction of that board and whether a pre-conference settlement type conference before parties can go before the board is jurisdictional or not. And what they hold is that pre-settlement conference is not jurisdictional. But in so holding, they address the jurisdiction of the board and say that is it has jurisdiction here. We don't have jurisdiction of this. It should go back to the board. The board shouldn't have kicked it out because the settlement conference didn't happen, which isn't jurisdictional. But the board itself does have jurisdiction. And Your Honor, beyond not addressing the statutory text, beyond not addressing this very long line of Supreme Court authority, you have to look into what the Sixth Circuit did hold, because it got that wrong too. And what it said is, they said, the reason we think this is non-jurisdictional is because the Supreme Court in Glover, which is a case involving race discrimination and union employer collusion, they say in Glover the Supreme Court created an exception, and they did it based on the party's conduct. And under another Supreme Court case, Kontrick, they say that can't be right because you can't create subject matter jurisdiction based on the party's conduct. But the Sixth Circuit misinterpreted both the Glover and the Kontrick case. What Glover held, Glover actually reaffirms the system board's exclusive jurisdiction in disputes between employees and carriers. And let me quote from the Glover case. What it holds is, quote, "It is true that this court has held that the Railroad Adjustment Board," and again, the Railroad Adjustment Board is treated the same as air carrier system boards in all the case law and under statute. "This court has held that the Railroad Adjustment Board has exclusive jurisdiction under Section 3(1) of the Railway Labor Act to interpret the meaning of the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. We have held, however, that Section 3(1), by its own terms, applies only to disputes between an employee or group of employees and a carrier or carriers." The Supreme Court then, in the Glover case, goes on to explain that the dispute in Glover is a dispute between employees and their union and management acting together. And they say, as opposed to a dispute between an employee and a carrier, which is exclusive jurisdiction. And that the Supreme Court then further explains that what it's excusing plaintiffs of in that case is exhaustion of remedies under the CBA, not the mandatory arbitration requirement for disputes between employees and carriers, which it actually reaffirms. And I'd like to make another point there. This is not just me reading Glover and putting out my interpretation of it. This court affirmed the Everett case, which is directly on point. And what Everett said about Glover matches that interpretation exactly. And let me quote, "The Supreme Court in Glover, distinguishing analytically between the exhaustion requirement and the mandatory arbitration requirement, noted that futility may be a defense to exhaustion, but not to mandatory arbitration, which is a jurisdictional matter." And so, Your Honor, what I'm putting forth is the Sixth Circuit got its interpretation of Glover wrong. And then it made another leap. It says, under Ryan v. Kontrick, they say subject matter jurisdiction can't hinge on the behavior of the parties. And they cite the Kontrick case, which actually held that subject matter jurisdiction, it was talking in dicta, but what it says is subject matter jurisdiction cannot be expanded to account for the party's litigation conduct. There's a significant difference between litigation conduct and conduct in general. And if conduct in general can give rise to subject matter jurisdiction depending on the circumstances, and an example of this is the Declaratory Judgment Act. You know, whether there's an actual controversy under the Declaratory Judgment Act is highly dependent on the party's general conduct, maybe not its litigation conduct, but pre-litigation general conduct. And a site for that is Shell Oil Company v. Amoco, 970 F. 2nd, 885-888, which, and I quote, "The legal effect of the party's conduct in particular, whether it was sufficient to create an actual controversy, is a question of law which we review de novo." So, Your Honor, in sum, I mean, the five reasons why I think the Sixth Circuit got it wrong is, one, they don't even analyze the statutory text. Number two, they don't address or even reference the long line of Supreme Court cases on point, which Arbaugh and Reed and these other cases hold is what you're supposed to do, look at the historical treatment. Number three, they misinterpret the Supreme Court's decision in Glover. Number four, they misinterpret the Supreme Court's decision in Kontrick. And then five, they don't address the Union Pacific case, which just came out in 2009.
You need to wind it up. Go ahead.
Yeah. Just to wind up, they make a lot of arguments about, well, they can't, the litigation counsel can't raise these arguments after the fact. And Your Honor, those cases have no application here. This is not a case where everyone agrees the court has jurisdiction. It's a question of whether the system board has exclusive jurisdiction, and if it does, the system board will decide what arguments it will and won't consider, and the CBA is directly on point and says that the system board can consider whatever evidence it deems admissible. But even assuming for the sake of argument those cases applied here, they're irrelevant because They depend on a complete administrative record. Here there is no administrative records. The system board has never occurred. Number two, they only stand for the proposition that you can't offer a rationale later that you didn't raise earlier. From day one, the plan has said it's been a furlough. Number three, you have to look at the facts. This was an amendment that went into effect in 1997. He's denied these benefits in 2003. He calls up and says, why were they denied? They sent him a page from the 1997 plan that says if you're furloughed, you don't get benefits. There was no allegation whatsoever until this litigation that he claimed the 1997 amendment was invalid. And the last point on that, and I'll sit down, Your Honors, is that what's under the case law, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And the cases, if they do apply, they specifically hold, and I'm quoting Flinders, which Oki cites for the rule that a plan cannot assert new rationales, and I quote, they talk about the converse also applies, and the claimant can assert new things. And they say this is consistent with the converse rule that a claimant may not urge new grounds outside the administrative record that would support the award of benefits. This was never raised about the 1997 plan being invalid until this litigation. If somehow we were precluded from addressing it, that would be improper under the same cases he cites.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. How much time does Mr. Shelley have? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple of points about the jurisdictional versus non-jurisdictional question. The Sixth Circuit's decision in Emsweiler is not a drive-by ruling. They went through all of the cases starting with Arbaugh and actually expressly mentioned the Union Pacific case. My colleague says they don't, and that comes on page 789 where they discuss the Union Pacific case and say that the Supreme Court has also applied the Arbaugh clear statement test in the context of the RLA. Citing Union Pacific. In Union Pacific, the court decided that noncompliance with the RLA requirement that parties to a minor dispute take part in a pre-arbitration settlement conference prior to bringing their claim to the adjustment board was not jurisdictional. The Sixth Circuit wasn't doing a drive-by ruling. In fact, it overruled earlier cases that had said it was a jurisdictional ruling and to come to its own conclusion. Mr. Robertson mentions that the statutory text he cites mentions the word jurisdiction, but it doesn't say the courts don't have jurisdiction. It just talks about the scope of the jurisdiction of the System Adjustment Board. And this
but it does use the word jurisdiction, and there is a lot of precedent that says it's exclusive. And using the term jurisdiction is one of the key things the Supreme Court has said to look for, right?
But the Supreme Court in Reed Elvezier specifically said, but simply the mention of the word jurisdiction doesn't suddenly turn something into jurisdictional. You have to look at whether it's saying, does the court lack jurisdiction? That's not what is in the statutory text. With respect to how long the defense went without being raised, the case was stayed from about 2000, began in 2003, was stayed from about 2006 to about 2009.
I thought the stay was lifted in May of 11.
I think it was officially lifted in 11, but there were proceedings before then that the parties went through because we had moved to reopen the case. So it probably is fair to say that during that period there were no court proceedings in the case. But this claim has been in the complaint since the very start. It's not fair to say it wasn't in the complaint in 2003. The disability plan was only a named plaintiff for that sole reason, for the disability claim that was claim six. The contour of the claim never changed from 2003 to the later amended complaints. And then one last point I'd like to mention is that the argument now being made that Mr. Oki had the obligation to raise the 1997 plan infirmity during the appellate process, which they never responded to, he did. If you look at his appeal letter in the record, it specifically notes, we don't know where you got this plan. It's undisclosed to us. This doesn't look like the correct plan to us. He specifically said it in his appeal. The plan never responded to that appeal, and it wouldn't have mattered anyway because there's significant case law on the point that all he had to do was appeal. He didn't have to raise specific issues, and I'd point to two cases for that. The Ninth Circuit's Vaught case, V-A-U-G-H-T, at 546 F3rd 620 from 2008, and the Third Circuit's case, Wolf versus National Shopman, 728 F2nd 182 at page 186. That's from the Third Circuit, 1984. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you.